free audiobook written by Alain Besançon. Performed by Darren Elliker. Chapter 5. To the same extent that Milos found airports in general insipid, Grand Central Station was for him a veritable neoclassical cathedral dedicated to Hermes and Kronos, who must have enjoyed the incessant mass of these busy pilgrims who venerated them without knowing it. The immense hall was a crossroads of the destinies of those arriving from all corners of the country, armed with their dreams and their illusions, and those returning to where they had come from, used up by the asperities of life. Milos asked himself if, when they exchanged looks, they recognized each other, and in the space of the batting of an eyelid, sent their own images into the past for the one, and into the future for the other. Milos observed the slow, inexorable movement of the needles of one of the numerous clocks which blossomed on the monumental walls of the terminal. Soon, he would be able to speak with Eva in person, to see her, and to prove that all this was not simply a fantastic hallucination. The magazine firmly lodged in his arms, he advanced to track 18 in search of the fiery hair which he waited to see from one moment to the next. At 2 o'clock, a train stopped at the platform. Passengers disembarked while others boarded. Milos tried not to lose his footing in the human flood. This unexpected chaos was exasperating, and he began to seriously doubt his chances of finding Eva. Track 18, 204, said a recorded voice announcing the immediate departure of the express train to Boston, when he perceived a graceful and leaping form rushing into a car at the other end of the platform. He thought he made out a red blur, but could not be sure. There was no more than a few seconds before the closing of the doors. "I've always wanted to visit Boston," he said to himself, as he stepped up onto the train. Chapter 6. In the course of the last few weeks, the private investigation team dispatched by Hector had made considerable progress. The circumstances of Jason's death had become much more clear. The progressive discovery of the odious reality was a veritable torture for Hector. Each new piece of news which lifted a bit of the mystery was an extra stab in the heart of the bereaved father. The report from the in-depth medical analysis was clear. Jason had died of a myocardial infarction provoked by an overstimulation of exogenous origin. Minute traces of nano-implants left no doubt about Jason's belonging to the world of the feelers, a fact which Hector discovered in the most terrible way. The investigators, leaving nothing to chance, had identified the provenance of the implants. They had been fabricated by secret laboratories, which procured the components of the bases on the black market, itself supplied in a totally illicit manner by factories unloading their unsold stocks. These factories were the flower of Hector's empire. To the guilt of not having known how to stop his son from becoming an extreme vibes addict, was added that of having contributed indirectly to his tragic demise. He almost regretted having launched himself on this search for truth, the lie and denial having been more comfortable. But the grief was too strong, and had to be appeased by the suffering of the guilty ones. The fabricators of the implants were impersonal entities. Hector needed to exercise his vengeance on another human being, and the VJs were the perfect target. He needed to find the VJ who had led Jason in his last trance. Hector had used his networks of influence in all areas, risked his relationships, twisted arms, greased palms, used his best bloodhounds, spent without counting, and he had found him. The investigation phase over, Hector had launched the phase of action, which was to lead to the ultimate and most awaited stage of execution. Chapter 7. She had uncommon physical and mental aptitudes, but for Eva, being on time remained an extraordinary exploit. Evidently, she had grossly underestimated the time necessary to get to Grand Central, but had still succeeded in barely catching her train. Alone in her seat, she saw the parade of buildings without souls pass by, and mused on her missed rendezvous with the stranger with the magazine. Her curiosity would probably remain unsatisfied. At that precise moment, a magazine materialized on the unoccupied seat next to her, followed immediately by a voice.
"Hello, Eva. I'm very happy to be able to meet you at last. Thanks for accepting my invitation."
The man took back his contemporary art magazine and sat down facing her.
"Virgil," Eva responded, confused at having been taken by surprise. "I have followed your career with much interest for several months, and I am sincerely impressed with your talent."
For a long time habituated to the monastic rigor of the Kirov and to its iron discipline which wore down less well-forged personalities, Eva was not used to someone being interested in her person. She had the candid coolness of exceptional beings who no longer take notice of their potential. Virgil did not correspond to the romantic image that she had of a patron of the arts. A partially bald man in his 50s, of average size and weight, dressed in a sober dark gray suit, with a gray trimmed beard complementing a face creased by deep wrinkles. Eva did not notice a ring on his bony fingers, not even a watch on his wrist. He would pass completely unnoticed, if not for his strange look. Eva was captivated by his blue, almost gray eyes, which seemed to her like untinted mirrors reflecting the whole world and dissimulating the observer. The warmth of his smile contrasted with the sad expression on his face, which reminded Eva of a winter trip between St. Petersburg and Helsinki, where the low sky and the frozen sea congealed into a pale atmosphere between dawn and dusk.
"Do you always hold your meetings on trains?" asked Eva with a smile.
"Why do two things at once when you can do three?" asked Virgil with irony.
"That must be the type of principle that lets you become wealthy."
"Wealth is absurd if it is not used to promote beauty."
"That leads us to your project, which I hope will become our project before we arrive in Boston."
Eva did not ask herself too many questions. This man seemed ready to help her transform her dream into reality, and she would not let this chance pass.
"Well, Virgil, here is how I imagine my next performance."
Chapter 8. Milos had traversed half of the cars in search of Eva, who remained impossible to find. Finding Eva had become a feverish obsession. Since Paris, the existence of this woman had developed in his mind like a virus, making a profound transformation in his consciousness. He was split between the ardent desire to find her and the fear of finally discovering only a chimera, or worse still, of being disappointed by reality. Entering the restaurant car, Milos was taken by a sort of vertigo, his head empty, his stomach full of lead, his throat dry, the beating of his heart resonating in time with the rhythm of the car bumping along the uneven rails. He was in mental apnea, and Eva was there before him only a few meters away. She advanced in his direction, floating through the air with a graceful step, supple and feline, with that capacity of curving space and time around her, becoming the involuntary center of attention of her immediate universe. Her clothes seemed to be taken right off the page of a fairy tale. She wore a tight green silk blouse, whose wide collar showed her delicate neck to great advantage, and exposed the edge of her fine and muscular shoulders, over which streamed a cascade of strawberry blonde hair. On her feet, she wore high boots of brown suede, which revealed the perfect curve of her calves, and invariably led one's look upward to her thighs, whose finely chiseled muscles undulated under a carmine satin fabric. The haughty way she held her head reinforced her allure of a Cossack princess. Her only jewelry was her emerald eyes, which fueled the inferno consuming Milos's soul. Beginning to breathe again, Milos took note of the man who accompanied her and with whom she was in deep discussion.
The two took a table, and Milos imitated them so he could continue to observe Eva. She spoke with passion, and her face was resplendent with life, betraying no doubt, no fear, no falsity. After a few moments, the man got up, and Milos seized the opportunity to finally break his anonymity. Virgil had absented himself to make some telephone calls, and Eva saw a stranger approach her table. The man was tall, very slender, and did not seem to have slept more than 3 hours in the last year. "I'm Milos. We spoke earlier today."
"The man with the magazine. Sorry for the missed meeting. Sit down. I'll buy you a drink."
Milos did so, and then they were rejoined by Virgil. Chapter 9.
"Virgil, this is Milos, an acquaintance from New York who wandered onto the same train as us today," said Eva, without any shadow of hesitation.
"Really?" said Virgil, who planted his eyes on those of Milos for a few seconds too long.
"Nice to meet you," said Milos, thinking to himself that Virgil must have stolen such eyes from a barracuda.
"What leads you to Boston, Milos?" Virgil inquired.
Milos turned to Eva and noted the sketch of a smile forming a deliciously mischievous pout.
"Some business that I want to clear up." "What kind of business are you in?" Virgil continued automatically.
"So, Virgil, what do you think of my performance project?" Eva interrupted, visibly wanting to avoid putting Milos in too uncomfortable a situation.
Virgil let his eyes rest for a few more seconds on Milos' face, as if to immerse himself in it.
"My dear Eva, your ideas are fascinating, and I am dying of desire to see them become reality. I'm going to make some arrangements, and if everything passes as I hope, you will be able to make your new performance in 30 hours.
Eva, incredulous, sat with her mouth open. Even in her craziest dreams, she had not imagined being able to pursue her career as an independent dancer as quickly or in such conditions. She expected to have to spend years working on minor productions, just looking for the means to set up the necessary infrastructure for the organization of a fusion ballet. And here was Virgil, coming out of nowhere, offering her dream on a platter.
"Virgil, but how? I can't believe it."
"In a few minutes we will arrive in Boston, where my team is waiting to take us to the place of the performance."
"Where?"
exclaimed Eva, who had 1,000 questions to ask and whose excitement had abolished all rationality.
"I would like our next destination to remain a surprise, but so that you will be able to prepare yourself mentally, I can give you a clue."
"Virgil, please," Eva whimpered like a capricious little girl.
"The performance will take place by an ocean."
"But the equipment, the scene, the public, my preparation."
Suddenly all the material constraints of the performance erupted in Eva's head, not to mention the enormous nerve of launching on such an adventure in so short a time.
"All the logistics will be ready. Don't worry about it. All you have to do is simply concentrate on the essence of your art."
Virgil and Eva continued to talk for a few minutes, the patron of the arts trying to channel the artist's explosion of enthusiasm. Then they remembered the presence of Milos, who had drank in their words silently, distilling a mass of information and trying to give it all some sense. Following the discussion between Eva and Virgil, Milos began to understand the nature of their relationship, but he had not yet succeeded in understanding his role. Eva considered Milos. He was an enigma that had still not been resolved. The priority was, of course, the performance, but she would surely find a moment for a private conversation with him.
"I would like Milos to accompany us," Eva said to the two men.
"Do I really have any choice?" responded Milos, plunging his eyes into Eva's in search of a response.
"So you agree," Eva concluded, turning toward Virgil, miming the authoritarian diva who will not tolerate a refusal.
"Your desires are my command, Eva," said Virgil, with a false servility as he threw Milos a look which tied his stomach in knots.
Thank you for listening to Call Me, written by Alain Besançon and performed by Darren Elliker. You may discover other titles from the same author at www.alainbesançon.com.